It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, we'll take a look at accusations that state Republicans have taken control away from local governments on a wide variety of issues.
First, voters went to the polls last night in Illinois, North Carolina, Missouri, Florida, and Ohio to cast their ballots for presidential hopefuls from both parties.
Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton swept many of the states, as did businessman Donald Trump, whose victory in Florida led Senator Marco Rubio to drop out of the race.
But what does this mean moving forward? Will parties begin to coalesce around a candidate? Presidential hopefuls Bernie Sanders and Ted Cruz are still vying for the nomination.
Or could the GOP see a contested convention this summer, since Ohio Governor John Kasich dominated in his home state last night?
Joining us to analyze last night's results is Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538. He joins us every week to talk about all things Washington. Harry, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, let's start with the winners, starting in the Democratic camp. Hillary Clinton maintaining a strong lead over Bernie Sanders despite his popularity, and she swept Sanders in every state last night. And here's what she had to say in her victory speech.
We are moving closer to securing the Democratic Party nomination and winning this election in November. You know, because of all of you and our supporters across the country, our campaign has earned more votes than any other candidate, Democrat or Republican.
You're looking strong after last night. Harry, how would you describe her position at this point?
Inevitable nominee. I mean, look, this is a game of math. On the Democratic side, all of the delegates are awarded proportionally. It's very, very difficult to make up what is now an over 300 delegate deficit. Sure, Bernie Sanders has got some good states coming up, but they're all small states, all states that he'll win. But even if he wins them by a fairly strong margin, he'll only be able to cut into that deficit by, say, 50 or 60 delegates. Clinton has pretty much got this. And, you know, it is, sure, it's nice that she won the five states. But it's winning in places like Florida by 31 percentage points, winning in Ohio by 14 percentage points. These types of margins that Clinton has allowed her to build up a delegate lead so that even if Sanders was able to win a whole bunch of states, he can't be winning them by small margins. It was like last night in Missouri, for instance, Sanders was so close to winning. But even if he won, the delegate difference would have been so small. I just do not see how it is possible, unless Clinton has some sort of scandal or something just that's awful to even think about happen to her, I just don't see how she is not the nominee come the Democratic National Convention.
And you say the math doesn't add up, Hillary Clinton looking inevitable, and yet the Bernie Sanders camp releasing language saying, look, we're still feeling good about this, we're hanging in there, we're going to take states coming up. So what do you think, they're looking at the same math that you're looking at, what do you think that they're seeing or hoping for?
Well, I mean, Marco Rubio said he was going to win Florida up until the second the polls closed, and then he lost the state by 18 points. I mean, campaigns say things, right? Look, Bernie Sanders is going to win votes. He has a core constituency within the Democratic Party. So far, that's been worth about 40% of the vote. That's not bad. That's pretty good, 40% of the vote of a major party. But, again, wins don't matter. Winning states don't matter. It's the margin by which you win states and how many delegates are in those states. And when you just go state by state by state, Bernie Sanders does well in places, you know, where did he win big so far? Like Kansas, Maine. He won in Nebraska. He won in Vermont. He won, you know, in Minnesota. Of those, none of them have anywhere close to the delegates that are in states like Ohio, Florida, Texas. So, sure, they're going to say they're going to win. But if we're all being real with ourselves and looking at the math, it's just not there.
Well, and so if by necessity he can't be in it to win it anymore, is he going to be in it to influence the race?
Absolutely. I mean, look, when Bernie Sanders started his campaign, what is now almost a year ago, I wrote that he could be quite influential in shaping the debate, the debate, and moving Hillary Clinton further to the left. Now, Clinton has moved further to the left during this campaign. I'm not sure how much of that is Sanders versus just Clinton knowing where the Democratic base is. But he's clearly made a difference. He's clearly shaped the discussion. And he has all the right in the world to continue to do so. He has the money. He has a lot of supporters out there. So why shouldn't he stay in and hope to win some states and help to influence the discussion even more so?
Yeah, here's a little taste of what Bernie Sanders had to say last night.
And the reason that we have done as well as we have, the reason that we have defied all expectations, is that we are doing something very radical in American politics. We're telling the truth.
Bernie Sanders there speaking last night. He did not come away in the winner's circle. Hillary Clinton did. We're talking national politics right now with Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538. And looking at, you know, the race from a kind of a macro level, there are some narratives here of voters maybe not looking for establishment candidates. Voters who are looking to be radical see radical changes. From that perspective, how do you frame the role of Bernie Sanders in this race and where the race might be going overall, no matter who the nominee is?
Well, you know, let's take a macro look at this and step back for a second. Bernie Sanders is someone who is not a registered Democrat, was not a Democrat in the United States, and he was an independent who caucused with the Democrats up until a few months ago. He is an over 70-year-old, basically Democratic socialist from the state of Vermont who got no establishment support whatsoever and has gotten 40% of the vote in a Democratic primary. That, to me, is really impressive. And he's raised a ton of money. If this were, if Hillary Clinton was not so well liked by the, you know, had all these endorsements, had all this goodwill among African Americans, especially in the South, Bernie Sanders could have been even closer. But the fact that he was able to go up against the Clinton machine and do as well as he has done, I think tells you how much people want an outsider this year. On the Republican side, there was no figure like Hillary Clinton, so Donald Trump was able to sort of do what he's been doing. But on the Democratic side, Sanders was able to do a whole lot. And if you look at the exit polls, for instance, you see more Democratic voters than ever identifying as liberal. You know, oftentimes, if you look back at 1964 on the Republican side, Barry Goldwater did not win the presidential race that year. But then look 16 years later, there was Ronald Reagan who sort of said many of the things and embodied many of the same positions that Barry Goldwater did. Even if Bernie Sanders does not win this year, which he's probably not going to do, he has set the course forward for a Democratic Party that will be different than the Democratic Party of 8 years ago and certainly 16 years ago, which was much more centrist.
And at the end of the day, you're still talking about a different strand of the Democratic Party. Now, with the Republican Party, you actually have people talking about, well, maybe this will be a spinoff party. How do you see what's happening on the Republican side?
What a mess. I mean, look, you got a front runner in Donald Trump who still has not gotten a majority of the delegates that have been allocated so far, who needs, 54-55% of the delegates that are still to be allocated in order to win on a first ballot come the Republican National Convention. He still has not won a majority of the vote in any of the states that have voted so far. A good percentage, 40-45% of Republican voters, do not really like him. And yet, he is the favorite. What a mess. I mean, you look, I've never seen this, where you literally have groups that are spending money anti-Trump. It's not like, you know, people look back at the Democratic race in 2008 and say, oh, there were a lot of Obama voters who didn't like Clinton, a lot of Clinton voters who didn't like Obama. That's not what this is. This is literally people saying, I will get behind anybody to stop Donald Trump. I don't care if it's Ted Cruz, who maybe 10 months ago I couldn't stand, but compared to Donald Trump is a breath of fresh air. This is very different. Who knows what exactly is going to happen? We still got a lot of primaries to play out. And if you look at the different delegate math that people are putting out, even the people who think he'll be able to win on the first ballot don't have him getting a majority of the delegates until June in the California primary. This is a complete mess, and Hillary Clinton has got to be laughing right now at the fortunate position that she's been put in.
And we haven't really talked about the demise of Marco Rubio in depth. I mean, he started out as the establishment golden boy, and you know, here is Florida, lost his home state. How would you frame what happened to Marco Rubio?
Well, I think there were a few things that happened. Number one, remember, he hasn't run an election at state in 6 years. He probably wasn't there often enough in that state, making sure that he had the support that was necessary. He was also, as you said, someone who was elected as a Tea Partier type, and then he went to Washington and did a number of things. Really, the big thing was the immigration reform package that I think upset a lot of Tea Party voters. And Florida is a very unique state. He won his home area, Miami-Dade County, by a very wide margin, but lost every single other county in the state. Donald Trump just connected a lot better with the types of people who vote down in Florida, a lot of old people, a lot of white people, a lot of people who, you know, have been more in line with the Tea Party than did Marco Rubio. I would just say that Marco Rubio, I guess maybe John Kasich being the exception, still being in the race, was really that last sort of gasp of hope for the establishment candidate this year. There is just nobody left. It is very clear that the Republican primary electorate just simply wants to go in a different direction than what establishment politicians have wanted. And it'll be very interesting to see if we do get a contested convention, whether or not they would, A, try to take the nomination away from Donald Trump, even if he has a plurality of delegates going in, and B, would they dare try to put somebody in the nomination slot who perhaps is more an embodiment of the establishment. But right now, the Washington crowd on the Republican side is very different from what the voters are actually feeling.
We're talking with Harry Enten right now, senior political writer and analyst for 538, and he's here with us to talk about last night's primary races and the road ahead for the candidates that are still in the race.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you think the Republicans will end up with a contested convention? Do you think that's where they should end up, and who do you hope comes out on top? On the Democratic side, do you think Hillary Clinton has it all locked down, or is there still hope for the Sanders campaign? And who are you planning to vote for when the primaries come to Wisconsin next month? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
We're continuing our conversation about last night's presidential primary races with Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 with three left on the Republican side, two on the Democratic side. Who do you think you'll win? Who are you pulling for? Who are you voting for next month in Wisconsin? For Democrats and Republicans, what do you think of your front runner, Clinton or Trump? Call 800-642-1234. One candidate who will no longer need your vote next month, Marco Rubio. Here he is last night.
While it is not God's plan that I be president in 2016 or maybe ever, and while today my campaign is suspended, the fact that I've even come this far is evidence of how special America truly is.
Senator Marco Rubio dropping out of the race last night. And Harry, before we went to the news there, you were talking about the prospect of a contested convention for Republicans and what would happen if establishment Republicans try to, you said, take away, you know, the nomination from Donald Trump. Donald Trump has responded, said if that happened, he thinks there would be riots in the streets. What do you think would happen in that scenario?
I hope there aren't riots in the streets, and then Trump kind of backtracked, and, or at least some Republican insider said, oh, he was just joking. I'm not quite sure he was joking, but I don't know. Look, we have not had anything like this in modern political history. Remember, we've only had the modern sort of primary process put into place since the early 70s, and since then there has not really been a contested convention, maybe on the Republican side in 1976, but really not. Nothing like this, and nothing with a figure like Trump who really divides the Republican Party into two. I'm not sure that there's a way that that Republican convention will go where it's all neat and tidy. I mean, even if Trump wins on the first ballot, there's still going to be a ton of Republicans who are very, very upset with his nomination. So if they were to, let's say Trump doesn't win the nomination on the first ballot and then someone else wins that on the second, third, fourth, or dare I say fifth ballot, I think it partially will depend on who that person is. Is there a unifying figure within the Republican Party that can heal the wounds? I'm highly skeptical. You either love Trump or you don't. And if you don't, you really don't love him. And if you love Trump, you really do love him. So I really don't know what to expect. I mean, I'm going to Cleveland, and I'm going to be bringing my football helmet and maybe my gas mask. I mean, that is how divided that this Republican Party is.
I mean, do you think there's a scenario in which Ohio Governor John Kasich, as he is hoping, could step in and be the white knight to the Republican Party at a scenario like that?
I mean, he's certainly thinking so. I mean, if you do the math, he literally needs more than in order to win on the first ballot, he needs more delegates than are left available. So clearly the only way he can win is on a second or third ballot. Again, where has John Kasich won this primary season? Places like Hanover, New Hampshire, Ann Arbor, Michigan, the inner Chicago loop. These are not places known for being Republican strongholds. They are known for being elitist places for white liberals. This is not a candidate in my mind who is going to be able to unify the Republican Party, but you know what? Maybe he can. You know, he was able to do in Ohio last night what very few had been able to do so far, and that was win moderate voters which Trump voters often are. They call themselves moderate, even though a lot of people might disagree with that. Moderate voters, and was able to win them by a very large margin. If he is able to do that in another primary, then maybe we'll have a conversation. But until that happens, I think we can only describe Kasich's success so far has been limited to white liberal areas and his home state.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Megan on the line in Milwaukee. And by the way, you can join us at 800-642-1234. Megan, hi.
Hi. So I have two things. So one, I love Bernie Sanders. I'm going to vote for him, even though he's super behind. But ultimately, the thing that bothers me about Hillary Clinton being the nominee is that I think even Republicans that have died will come back to vote against her, even though they hate Trump, right? So that really bugs me. And I'm one of the Democrats that will not vote for Hillary Clinton because I don't agree with her Iraq war vote. But I'm still going to vote, and this is my plan. My plan is to vote, write in somebody on the Republican ticket. So I'm taking a vote away from the Republicans, but still voting, but not voting for Hillary. Can you just tell me if that makes any sense to you?
All right. Megan's got a strategy there. Harry, does it make any sense?
If she doesn't want to vote for Hillary Clinton but doesn't want to give a vote to the Republicans, then she could vote as put a write-in or do what my father did 4 years ago and vote for the Green Party. That makes perfect sense. If you don't like Hillary Clinton, then that's your prerogative. I do wonder whether or not the caller will, in fact, if Trump becomes the nominee and makes some more outlandish statements, will then say, hey, maybe Hillary Clinton isn't so bad. But I think that what the caller said makes a lot of sense in terms of the primary. Bernie Sanders has a core amount of support. I expect him to win the Wisconsin primary and probably win it comfortably. These voters so far are really going along demographic lines. They're not straight racial lines. There's some economic parts of it as well, some age parts of it too. They're not moving. That is why I think Bernie Sanders is going to win a lot of votes going forward, is because he has a good core base within the Democratic primary that's going to help to continue allow him to win some votes.
All right. Thanks a lot, Megan. And we're going to go next to Mike joining us in Madison. Hi, Mike.
Hey, how you doing? I guess I don't want to – I'm just supporting Bernie Sanders this election. I have a lot of the same quarrels as the previous caller, the Iraq war vote. Also, her ties to Wall Street. She gave those Goldman Sachs speeches. She gave 3 speeches and makes more than I'd make in 20 years of working. And that really kind of bothers me, especially her answer to it in the debate. Like, nope. Like, it was just kind of snooty. Also, her email scandals. Like, I'm in the National Guard here in Wisconsin, and if I did anything close to what she did, I would probably be in jail right now, or at least in the process of being punished on my way out of the military. And it's just like, in Wisconsin, I think we're really seeing why Bernie Sanders would win the primary is we've seen a bought-out candidate with Scott Walker. He's in the pockets of, you know, fossil fuel industry, fracking, and it's having a lot of repercussions to those areas.
Mike, thanks a lot. I want to make sure we get Harry in on this. And Harry, you hear about polarization in the political parties. There's a lot of polarization around the 2 Democratic candidates as well. Why the response? Do you have any rationale about the way people are thinking and what Wisconsin is thinking?
Well, I mean, Wisconsin has historically supported the more of the liberal candidates. I mean, think about 8 years ago, Barack Obama did very well in the state. Hillary Clinton has simply not been liked in the state of Wisconsin for a long time coming. I hate to sound like a broken record, but there are plenty of things about Hillary Clinton that voters do not like. And that is why if you look not just at the Democratic primary, but the general electorate at all, she tends to have a net negative favorable rating. It just so happens that Donald Trump has an even worse net favorable rating. This is going to be an election in which it truly is, if Trump ends up winning the nomination, as I expect Clinton will almost certainly, where voters will face a choice in which I think they would rather stay home and stuff their heads in a piece of pie. I mean, I guess a piece of pie would actually be a pretty good thing to stuff your head into, but you get the general point. The idea being that these are 2 people that are really not liked. But at the end of the day, elections are choices. You can't vote against both candidates. You have to vote for one of them or vote for a third-party candidate, but most people vote for one of the 2 major party candidates. And that's why Hillary Clinton, on the betting markets right now, for instance, is a heavy favorite for the general election, is because Donald Trump is so disliked that even if Hillary Clinton has her problems, and she certainly does with the general electorate, they aren't anywhere near as big as the problems that Donald Trump's been having.
And Harry, just taking the big picture again, giving these counter-establishment strands in both parties this election cycle, I mean, what sorts of scenarios are you looking at it? What kind of a political world we could wake up to the day after the presidential election?
Well, if Donald Trump were to lose by the margin that some of the polls are indicating right now, and a number of them have indicated either high single-digit or low double-digit loss, if that were to happen, that would be a very interesting Republican Party, because here it is that you really did get an anti-Washington type of politician, right? I don't think anyone would ever say that Donald Trump is representative of your Washington politician. Yes, he's been around and funding some candidates and so on and so forth, but he is the anti-politician. If he loses by 9-10 points, what are voters who are part of the Tea Party or see themselves as part of the Tea Party or outsiders going to say? They can't say, oh, man, I wish we would have chosen a more outsider candidate. How much more outsider can you get than Donald Trump? So I think that you would probably get some sort of an establishment strikes back type thing, which we saw sort of in 2000. If you remember, George W. Bush won the Republican nomination on being the compassionate conservative, being more middle of the road. Even John McCain was even more middle of the road.
We got to leave it there, Harry. Lots to talk about. But thanks so much for joining us. This is Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. The state Senate finished up its session yesterday, and one recurring theme in this meeting of the legislature has been the issue of gun control, of local control, rather. Earlier this year, a Democratic state lawmaker asked the Legislative Fiscal Bureau for a list of bills that overrode local governments or created unfunded mandates for them. The Bureau found 99 of those laws since 2011, with another 21 more in the works at the time.
That added to ongoing criticism of the legislature and of the governor on the local control issue. Democrats and some local officials say the state is overstepping its authority. But the sponsors of individual pieces of legislation say the state needs to step in so citizens and businesses don't have to navigate a confusing patchwork of local laws.
One of the latest bills just passed by the Senate would make it impossible for local governments to ban plastic bags at stores. Other laws over the last few years affect local government authority on shoreline protection, landlord-tenant relations, cell phone tower placement, and more.
Eric Giordano joins us now. He's an associate professor of political science and director of the Wisconsin Institute for Public Policy and Service at UW-Marathon County. Eric, welcome to the show.
Hey, glad to be here.
Also with us is Jerry Duchesne. He is executive director of the League of Wisconsin Municipalities. Jerry, thanks for joining us today.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Well, Eric, let's start with you. Is there any agreed notion of what the division of labor should be between state and local governments?
Not really. This has been an ongoing issue for really a long time. I mean, it was an ongoing issue in the 1920s when they finally decided in Wisconsin to ratify an amendment to the Constitution providing that cities and villages could, you know, have this determine their local affairs. But there was this clause in there that also said that basically, unless there were matters that were of statewide concern, and that, I think that's been the tipping issue the whole, you know, since that time. How much is it the prerogative of local control and local governments to have control, and how much is the prerogative of the state? The Supreme Court has consistently sided with the state on legal matters, but I think there's always been a balance, and I think maybe the question is whether the balance is shifting now.
And we'll get into that, but Jerry, I wanted to ask you, the current government is and has been led by Republicans for some years now, but have you seen these conflicts with Democratic governors and lawmakers in the past?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, Eric is right, only I'd go back further than the 1920s. This has been a battle since the creation of statehood. Our lobbyists described it this way. When they passed the Home Rule Amendment in 1924, and the Home Rule Amendment essentially gave all authority to local governments unless the legislature wanted to take it back. So they gave us all the authority in 1924, and they've been taking back bits and pieces ever since.
That said, Jerry, though, do you think this last few years we've been seeing more of this than usual, more preemption of local control by the state government?
I have not seen statistics that would bear that out. I did see the memo that listed the 99, you know, various intrusions on home rule. But what I didn't see is what's the memo that goes back 10 years before that, 10 years before that. I think it's a recurring theme, and I think we always have to remind the legislature that it's generally held wisdom that the government that functions best is the one closest to the people. I don't think that's a partisan issue. I just think different pressures are brought to bear against legislators, and our job is to keep reminding them that, hey, these guys at the local level know what they're doing.
Eric, this has become a partisan issue to some extent. Republicans have been criticized by their partisan opponents for at the national level favoring more state control, but at the state level, at least in the last 4 or 5 years, overriding local control on key issues. Is there something to that?
Well, I think there's definitely a reason why there's some criticism, and I think you've kind of put your finger on it. The GOP has kind of staked a reputation for many years on local control, but let's also face it, the Constitution itself, the U.S. Constitution, has always, you know, favored states' rights, and there really isn't any mention of local rights in the Constitution. There's rights of people, there's rights of states, and so, you know, we're back to the issue that the state, that Jerry mentioned, that the state really has the ability to do whatever it really wants to do when it deems that in the matter of state concern. But I think the issue is some people feel like there might be a double standard. You know, why are we supporting local control in a federal-state context but not in a state-local context?
Talking to Jerry DeShane with the League of Wisconsin Municipalities, Eric Giordano from UW-Marathon County. He's a political scientist there, talking about local control versus state control on a wide variety of government issues. It's been raised lately as an issue, a lot of laws overriding local control. And Jerry, when we look at individual laws, you know, the cell phone tower placement, new plastic bag law that the Senate just passed, supporters of these kind of practices where they override local control say, look, citizens and employers shouldn't have to deal with a patchwork of local ordinances. Overriding them actually makes life easier for us, helps the business climate here. Is there something to that?
Well, I think there's an argument that can be made for that, but I think, and taking cell towers is probably the best example. Who is the best decision maker of where a cell tower ought to be located? Should that be done in Madison at the state capitol, or should that be done at the local level, where you can actually see what the impact of the placement is? It's a balance, and I think the founding fathers and mothers of the state intended it to be a balance. It just, in order to reach that balance, there has to be conflict. I would say this. I think the state legislature is a convenient one-stop shop sometimes for big business, and generally that's what we're talking about. We're not talking about small businesses asking for this. It's big businesses that, if I can get the problem addressed once at the state level, then I don't have to deal with it city by city by city.
Eric, sorry, Jerry, go ahead and finish up.
No, this is Eric. I was going to say, I think Jerry's right. That's one thing that I think gets lost. I don't think it's been any secret that the GOP and the Walker administration have been very open about trying to make Wisconsin a more business-friendly state. I think what's sometimes lost in the rhetoric is that the businesses that are being favored by and large by this type of legislation really are big business. It's not really the small businesses that are benefiting from this as much.
And I wanted to ask, we just heard in the news a little while ago about gun control legislation in the court. The state law sometime back had overridden local gun measures. The argument there is that's not a business issue, but for a citizen who's legally carrying a firearm, do they have to suddenly obey a different set of laws when they're driving from one municipality into another? Jerry, do you see that as maybe a case where a citizen's rights are better enforced, better protected at the state level?
No. I think because local government is accessible and accountable, let me put it to you this way. It's a whole lot easier to throw out a city council member than to throw out a state legislator. So by and large, I would say the government closest to the people is the one that's most accountable to them. And I think if you look at most of Gallup's polling numbers on government, the most trusted level of government is local government. So I don't think the case has been proved that the state knows best in just about any issue you're talking about.
And Eric, Jerry's saying that the local level is the most trusted level of government, but it's very, I think, often invisible to people, isn't it? Do we get out and vote? Do we pay close attention to what our local elected officials are doing? Maybe the state government level is a higher profile place to sort out these important issues.
Well, it certainly is a higher profile in many ways, and I would argue that the voting turnout statistics bear that out. You know, it's decreasing as you get down more to the local level, but, you know, still the question is on our shoulders as citizens if we care about local issues. If, as Jerry put it, we can either put in or put out the local city council person or the county board member, then, you know, it's our responsibility to do that. And so perhaps, you know, ultimately we have to point the finger to ourselves if we don't like the fact that legislation is starting to favor the state over local government. I think people can do something about that if they choose.
Jerry, I wanted to ask about kind of constituencies here. If I'm a big business group and I want a state law to override local governments, then I have contact with the legislators maybe. If I'm a advocacy group for, say, a gun-related organization, I can lobby the government. How do you, as an association of local governments, try to argue for your local control?
I think using a lot of the same techniques, and quite frankly, the other thing is we ask our local mayors and village board members to talk to their legislators, and perhaps even more importantly, to invite them to their local city council meetings. We've been doing that more and more lately, and I think you'll see even more of that, because another part of this is building a communications relationship between the two layers of government. We are always going to have this tension. And, you know, there's no ultimate solution, but more communication, better communication, being able to recognize one another when you see them on the street can only help.
We're talking about local control versus state control in Wisconsin government. After accusations that the governor and legislature have been overriding local government authority over the last few years, our guests are Jerry Duchesne with the League of Wisconsin Municipalities and political scientist Eric Giordano from UW-Marathon County.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. When should the local government be in charge, and when should the state set standards that apply everywhere? Do you think you see balance tipping too far in one direction or the other? And do you think maintaining local control should be a priority? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation about local government control in Wisconsin and concerns that the state legislature may be overriding the authority of city, town, and county governments. Our guests are Eric Giordano from UW-Marathon County and Jerry Duchesne with the League of Wisconsin Municipalities.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Where should the balance be? Are you worried that the state has done too much to restrict local governments, or do you think statewide laws usually make more sense than a patchwork of local regulation? Are there particular issues that you think should go one way or the other? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Jerry, you've been watching this for a while, obviously, this issue of local control. Do you think this is something that kind of comes and goes like a pendulum, or is it just sort of ad hoc, one bill here, one bill there?
I think it's more ad hoc, one bill here, one bill there. What we typically see is a legislator or an interest group will see a local government do something or threaten to do something, and they'll react. They'll say, "Whoa, wait a minute, you ought not be able to do that." If you remember back a few years when New York City banned those great big drinks, you couldn't buy the big drinks anymore at your local fast food. Well, Wisconsin, a legislator decided we shouldn't do that in Wisconsin. So we have a ban on big gulps here in Wisconsin. So that's where you see a lot of it.
A ban on big gulps, right?
Correct, yes. Excuse me. It's hard to do this double negative.
Right.
You know, and the same thing with the whole Christmas tree thing that passed yesterday. Legislators, and this was a bipartisan vote, I should point out. Legislators decided that fire chiefs should not be able to ban live Christmas trees in churches in Wisconsin. So you get these bans on bans.
And Eric, I wanted to ask, is this a Wisconsin issue, or are we seeing these battles being fought in states around the country?
Oh, goodness, this is happening all over the country. I mean, I think, in fact, this has been headline news in a lot of states. In Alabama, I was reminded of in Birmingham, they had wanted to pass specific laws around registering people to vote and around voter ID, and the state legislature came down with a law basically saying, you know, we couldn't, or Birmingham couldn't issue its own IDs that would allow voters to register and vote. So this is just one example, but this is really happening all over the country. And I think Jerry's right, this tension is, you know, it's certainly not limited to this era. It's been around for a long time. I was talking with the local village administrator recently, and he was reminding me, he said, you know, I have worked very well with my local Republican legislator, and they've been able to pass legislation that have created TIF districts just for my community, and that's been a huge benefit. Now, on the other hand, we wanted to pass a landlord law to sort of prevent properties from going downhill, and, you know, there was a ban on that, and I wasn't happy with that. So even within villages and municipalities, there's tension about, you know, the positives and negatives of this type of home rule versus state rule.
Well, and that's, if I can follow up on what Eric said, when the Wisconsin legislature was debating overriding local regulations on services like Uber and Lyft, I had major cities on both sides of that bill. I had the city of Madison deeply opposed to limitations on local regulations, and at the same time, the city of Racine saw they wanted to encourage more Uber and Lyft. So it's hard to paint a black and white picture sometimes, because there are quite a few shades of gray.
Well, but the idea here being that if the state passes a one-size-fits-all law, I guess neither Madison nor Racine gets to pick their path. The state picks it for them, in a way, would be the objection.
Yes. Yeah. And and that's why, you know, representing local government, my job is to push back as often as hard as possible for local control. But
yeah, and I think also, especially in times of economic distress, when communities are already, you know, trying to make their way and attract young people, retain young people, create jobs, et cetera, you know, I think every community wants the ability to sort of define themselves, say, here's who we are, here's what's going to be our identifying mark in Wisconsin. And it's tougher for communities to do that if there are laws that prevent them from separating themselves and identifying themselves in a particular way.
Let's bring in our callers now at 800-642-1234. Joan is on the line with us in Eau Claire. Joan, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I couldn't agree with your guest more. This is a direct result of the Tea Party legislators imposing control into the local communities of Wisconsin and many other states, unfortunately.
Joan, thanks for the call. Eric, do you think that there's something to be said for that? A Tea Party movement being part of a statewide effort to impose different laws on local governments?
Well, I'm not sure I completely agree. I definitely think there has been influence from the Tea Party on, you know, obviously elections and who's getting into power. And clearly there has been an agenda to pave the way for a more pro-business environment in Wisconsin. So if that is sort of the chain, I guess I could agree with that. I just think that it's not always that clear. I think Jerry said this earlier, but, you know, although there certainly, I think 99 bills passing in, you know, since 2011 is definitely a trend. But even before that, I think if you talk with local leaders, they recognize that Democrats sometimes took away local control as well. So I'm not quite sure it's quite as strong as maybe I would agree or disagree slightly with the caller.
Talking state versus local control of governments, that's Eric Giordano there, UW Marathon County political scientist. Jerry DeShane also with us, executive director of the League of Wisconsin Municipalities. Back to our callers now with Phyllis in Clark County. Phyllis, hi.
Hi. My question is this. State government has capped our property taxes. If they've taken away our ability to tax, haven't they taken away all of our powers?
Phyllis, thanks for that call. And this is one that affects schools. Jerry, I think that was you laughing. What do you have to say?
Phyllis hit the biggest nail squarely on the head. That is one area where the state, and they did this long, long ago, has passed the ultimate control, which is They control not only the level of property tax increases, but they also control all revenue sources that a local government can use. And that's fundamentally a major problem. You know, in Wisconsin, we're pretty much, we are the property tax for local government, and that's it. And that, frankly, it's not sustainable long term.
Yes, and I'm hearing the same thing. I was talking with the county executive recently, and he was mentioning that, you know, in his opinion, too much money isn't necessarily a good thing. You need some tension. You need a little pressure in order to make sure that you're not being wasteful. But he said, we've pulled all the rabbits out of the hat that we can possibly pull. There's nothing left to cut. And at this rate, they're going to have to face some serious trade-offs at the local level between services. And what he pointed out to me is that it's never the state legislators that get the blame. It's the local legislators. Well, why are you cutting this versus that? Well, they're cutting because they don't have the tax authority to raise the revenues that they need for all the services that the citizens want.
Jerry, briefly, magic wand, is that the one thing you might change about the balance of power, state and local government? More flexibility for raising money at the local level?
That would, as Phyllis explained, that would make the most difference, absolutely. They can have plastic bags.
All right, we'll leave it there. Jerry, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And Eric, thanks to you as well.
Yes, my pleasure.
We've been talking about local versus state control, a state overriding local government authority. We've had Jerry DeShane with us. He's executive director of the League of Wisconsin Municipalities and the Urban Alliance. And Eric Giordano. He's associate professor of political science and director of the Wisconsin Institute for Public Policy and Service at UW-Marathon County. Still a room for you to share your thoughts, by the way. Go over to the Central Time Facebook page and join the conversation there.
Indiana Jones. Always knew someday you'd come walking back through my door. I never doubted that. Something made it inevitable. So what are you doing here in Nepal?
I need one of the pieces your father collected.
That's Indiana Jones getting punched in the face in the original Raiders of the Lost Ark movie. And he's walking through our doors again to presumably get punched even more.
Disney announced the newest installation in the Indiana Jones franchise starring, no, not a new Indy,
nope,
but 73-year-old Harrison Ford, who seems like he's gotten a second wind in his sails. That's scheduled for release in 2019.
So we've seen the new Star Wars movie, Harrison Ford back as Han Solo. Blade Runner, there's a sequel coming out. Harrison Ford will be in it in some capacity as Rick Deckard again. And now another Indiana Jones movie. Yeah, I'll have what he's having if he could keep doing this stuff.
I know, and I only hope to see the same happen with Carrie Fisher. We see her in the new Star Wars movies, but I'd like to see her getting out there and doing stuff too. Some of these, it's great to see this generation of actors that we grew up with still out there, still doing it.
Right, and maybe there's room for more Harrison Ford, like Presumed Innocent 2 or The Witness sequel back to Amish Country or something like that. So more power to you, Harrison Ford. Stick around, more to come here on Central Time.